Amos Cohen, while a number of countries have passed laws prohibiting child marriage, an estimated 14 million girls under the age of 18, including girls as young as 10 or 12, are married off every year. It's especially common in countries that are experiencing instability due to conflict or displacement or natural disaster. Child marriage leaves girls vulnerable to both physical and psychological problems. It also has implications for community and global development. Today we talk with two women who are on the front lines in the fight to end child marriage, and let me introduce them to you. Gail Simak-Lamone is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where her work focuses on foreign policy and the fight to end child marriage. She's also a contributor to the Atlantic Defense One website, author of a book called The Dressmaker of Karkana, about a young entrepreneur who supported her community under the Taliban in Afghanistan. And Gail Simak-Lamone, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to join you.
Also with us is Anne Warner, Senior Gender and Youth Specialist at the International Center for Research on Women, where she leads the center's research on solutions to end the practice of child marriage. From 2012 to 2013, she was co-chair of Girls Not Brides, the U.S. Partnership to End Child Marriage. Anne Warner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anne Warner, let me begin with you. Is child marriage a human rights violation?
Absolutely. Child marriage is a fundamental violation of the rights of girls to have free and full consent to decide who they will marry, which is a consequential decision that really transforms their lives. Once that decision is denied, girls are also subject to additional human rights violations, including their right to safety and security, their right to education, their right to access health care, and to participate freely in the political, social, and economic lives of their communities.
Gail, same question to you. And is it because if someone is under 18, they really are not in a position to consent, in this case, consent to a marriage?
Well, yeah, and I think, as long as being a human rights violation, think about the loss of potential for the whole world when you think that one in three girls will marry before the age of 18, one in nine before the age of 15. That's a stunning figure, right? And you think about all that lost talent, because most of the time they are then pulled out of school and these children become not just brides, but wives in very short order, and mothers. And so what you find is it kids having kids.
And are we seeing rates going up, going down? I mean, there's a lot of instability in the world today, and I know from some of the reporting from refugee camps in Jordan, they're seeing an increase in child marriage. Is there any way to know, I'll toss this to you, Anne Warner, whether rates are going up or down when it comes to child marriage?
Yeah, it's mixed. As you mentioned, in Jordan, among Syrian refugees, we've had recent data from UNICEF that says the rates have decidedly gone up, in fact, more than doubled since the war began. And child marriage tends to be exacerbated when you have conflict and insecurity, the economic and social uncertainty that comes with conflict and displacement and families moving across borders or within borders without being able to secure their daughters' futures. This is often a strategy that they use. In other countries, the child marriage has started to go down. And in countries like Ethiopia, where it's been very prevalent, the government has really taken a concerted action. And Ethiopia is not alone among countries around the world that are starting to turn the tide on the practice of child marriage.
To you, Gail Simak-Lamone, do some parents, though, think of marrying off, let's say, a 16 or a 15-year-old daughter as a way within their cultural milieu or even within their circumstances that it's a way to protect her?
Absolutely. And as Anne said, you know, insecurity is exacerbating so much of the problem in many very unstable corners of the world. And so parents are not only worried about the risk to their children, but they're also worried about on occasion, how to feed them, right? How to keep them safe. And when parents feel like they can't meet those basic needs, then oftentimes child marriage is, you know, or marriage in their view, but what we consider child marriage, is a refuge. And part of, you know, we just did a paper from the Council on Foreign Relations, which was citing some ANZ data, basically talking about the fact that we have to pay attention to what's happening to girls at this most vulnerable time, because it doesn't matter just only to them. It also has consequences for their families, their communities, and not just stability, but also prosperity when you think about undereducated and uneducated youth and what that means for the future in terms of both economic prospects and security prospects. And it's not a pretty picture.
Well, and is this also in some countries' tradition? I mean, the idea that one would marry off, if I can use that phrase, marry off a child, a girl at the age of 13, 14, 15, that's part of the tradition of this culture, perhaps even country?
Sure. Traditional factors are part of the picture, part of the reason that parents choose to marry their daughters young, but they're only one piece of it. There are economic factors, there are cultural, social, religious, and as you say, traditional factors. And really what we find across the world in places where child marriage is common is that there are two sort of core drivers. One is poverty and economic insecurity, mm-hmm. where families and households have few options for their daughters. So marriage often seems like the best option. And the other core driver is gender inequality, where girls and women have fewer opportunities to participate in the social, economic, and political life of their communities than the investments their families make in them is to marry and to marry them as soon as possible. They're seen as a burden, often to their households that needs to be transferred to another household. So the economic as well as the gender inequitable social norms are two really important triggers that we have to consider in every context where child marriage is practiced.
Let me just pick up on something you said, Gail, about almost 10% of girls being married before the age of 14. And I'm just, you know, I'm trying to put myself into their situation, even if there are huge cultural differences, trying to imagine a 13, 14, or 15-year-old being ready for marriage.
Well, that's the thing. Absolutely. I mean, I've done a lot of interviews with girls who have been married off and some who have escaped it, and I have never yet met one young woman below the age of 15 who has willingly gone. And in fact, you know, there are a lot of times where they would say, you know, I didn't want to go, I didn't want to leave school, but I had no choice. Or parents won't even tell them that until it's happening that day. You know, so you have girls who would rather be in school, who would do almost anything to stay in school, and a system that is really not working in their favor. And even when parents want to favor them, it's so difficult for them because oftentimes it's as answers the economic piece. You know, how do they keep affording them? How do they pay for school fees? How do they pay for this extra mouth at the table? You know, and how do they basically defy traditions in many places where girls by the time of 13 and 14 become wives and mothers, what we think of as children and what they think of, most importantly, as children. And in fact, I had this debate with a diplomat who said, well, you know, this isn't something for us to get involved in from a Western country. And I said, well, you know, if these girls at age 13 and 14 know that they shouldn't be marrying men 3 and 4 decades older, then shouldn't fancy people and fancy rooms help them?
Well, and are we talking about, Ann Warner, in many cases, marrying or being coerced into marrying men that are decades older than them?
That's right. Girls who are married as children are more likely to be married to men who are much older than them. And that's certainly what UNICEF found in their analysis of what is going on among Syrian refugees in Jordan, that almost half of Syrian girls who are married are marrying men who are 10 or more years older. And that has profound implications for girls, because not only is the decision to marry being taken from them, but within that marriage, they are at a great disadvantage. They have far less power to negotiate the terms of their marriage, of their sex life with their husband, who is inevitably forcing them into sex before they're ready. And the consequences of that are profound, and they're lifelong. They don't last mm-hmm. just while these girls are children, but they extend throughout her life. And when you have a mother who is not empowered, then you have children who are worse off. So child marriage has multi-generational, intergenerational consequences.
And is it tied to increased levels of domestic violence, Anne?
Yeah, absolutely. Girls who are married before the age of 18 are at elevated risk of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse. And the mental health component of this is something that we're just really starting to know a little bit more about, but we need to do more work into what the implications of this practice are on girls' mental and emotional health throughout their lives.
And Gayla, is she valued because chances are she's a virgin? Are we talking about spouses that might be pedophiles, for instance?
Well, I mean, I think it's much less of a pedophile than it's really cultural, and oftentimes it's cultural tradition, or people taking advantage of children or girls in a very vulnerable state, right? And I think that the tradition part is hard to get at, but oftentimes, you know, we just did a Daily Beast piece and also a CFR paper that looked at some of the work ICRW was doing in India with Anne's group. On a pilot program that basically paid parents to keep their girls alive and unwed until the age of 18. And it's fascinating because basically the experiment was to revalue girl children. And you really see a difference because when girls are able to stay in school, what we saw in the interviews was that parents saw them so differently because they weren't leaving the house at age 13 and 14. And they saw them become good at math and good at science and talk about their dreams of becoming teachers or nurses or even bankers, one of the girls we met. And then their parents start to see them differently. And really, I think homegrown agents of change is the only way you change any of it.
And Anne Warner, is education key to kind of breaking this association of marriage and child brides?
Education is critical. ICRW did a study a couple of years ago where we looked across all of the programs that had been evaluated that were attempting to prevent child marriage. And one of the most promising strategies that we identified were those that brought girls either back into the schools when they had dropped out or helped to keep them in school. And we're talking about school being particularly critical when girls are adolescents. So secondary school is so important because that transition from primary to secondary also happens to be around the time that girls are experiencing puberty and when they start to become more vulnerable to a range of harmful outcomes, including forced and child marriage. So keeping them in school throughout that transition and up until they're 18, and also ensuring that they get a good quality education when they're in school, can really transform their own lives, their own opportunities, and the way that their parents and communities see them.
That's Anne Warner, who joins us along with Gail Samak-Lamone, and we are talking about the plight of child brides, the work being done to end child marriage. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think should be done about child marriage? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Good Shepherd Penn Partners supports WHYY. The Penn Institute for Rehabilitation Medicine provides inpatient rehab following a stroke, injury, or serious illness. Patients are medically managed by Penn Medicine physicians with rehabilitation provided by Good Shepherd Penn Partners therapists experienced in treating brain and traumatic injuries, stroke, neurologic illness, amputation, and more. Good Shepherd Penn Partners is the official therapy provider for Penn Medicine. Details at pennpartners.org or 877-969-7342.
Diamond Dallas Page used to be one of the world's top pro wrestlers. Now he's using yoga to help athletes endure the physical demands of their sports. Diamond Dallas Page talks to guest host Terry O'Reilly, coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI. Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Millions of people around the world are desperate to get into the United States, but sometimes it's just a matter of luck.
I just started bawling my eyes out, just crying, and my mom heard me from downstairs and was like, "No, you didn't," and came running upstairs. She just knew immediately what had happened.
Winning the green card lottery next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Girls who are married when they are under the age of 18, and millions of them are every year, are at higher risk for domestic abuse, for poverty, for health problems, especially associated with childbirth. We're talking with two people who are on the front lines working to end the practice of child marriage. Let me introduce them to you again. Gail Simak-Lamon, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, also contributing editor to the Atlantic's Defense One website, and Warner, senior gender and youth specialist at the International Center for Research on Women, ICRW, leads the center's research on solutions to end the practice of child marriage. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscoen. We want to know what you think. Let me get Sarah from Landenberg to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, since we don't consider that these girls have reached the age of legal consent, that if you take away the title of marriage, don't they qualify as meeting the definition of slavery, and why we don't use the term being sold into slavery or slavery for even a subset of these situations. And if we did, would it help or hurt the cause?
Sarah, all good questions. Gail, let me toss that first to you. Do we have Gail? No, we seem to have lost Gail. Anne, I'm going to give that to you.
Sure. Thank you so much for the question. And it does come up a lot. Should we be talking about child marriage as a form of slavery? I think that in certain contexts that might, get some more attention to the issue. I think, though, that we have to be careful not to demonize parents and families and communities who are making difficult decisions in very difficult circumstances. And it also may not resonate as a global, concept may not resonate when you're trying to really bring communities on board to help them understand how this issue, which may be just part of the kind of normal reality of the way things are done in their community, helping to bring them on board to understand the harmful consequences and help them to start to define some solutions to that can be really powerful. So we've found that taking an approach that is non-judgmental and brings people on board across the community can really help to inspire positive action to protect girls.
Sarah, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I have another semantic question for you, Anne Warner, which is the use of the word child versus and the word teenager. Obviously, if someone is 17, very different than if they're 10 or 12. Is child the right word?
Child is the internationally accepted word because the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is signed by most governments in the world, establishes that a child is anyone 17 or below. So we use that to create a bright line and to help to establish that there is an age of consent that is globally recognized and understood. Now, you do raise a good point that there are potentially more vulnerabilities for a girl who is married at the age of 12 mm-hmm. than a girl who is married at the age of 17. And we need to make sure that our responses are carefully considering the really vast disadvantages to health, to well-being, in every possible way that someone as young as 12 or even 8 or 9 would face when forced to marry.
And I think we have Gail Simak-Lamon back. Do we have you back, Gail?
I am.
Okay, very good. I did want to, we haven't really talked about childbirth. And if we're talking about children, certainly, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-olds or maybe even younger, about, I guess, the health risks of childbirth for them. Can you speak about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, childbirth is actually the greatest threat to lives for girls under the age of 20, 15 to 19, I think is the actual number in much of the world. That's what kills them. And, you know, I think we want to talk about not just the lost potential in terms of the contributions these girls could make, but also the real risks to their families and their communities that this practice brings with it. Because this really is a huge threat to their lives, and thus you have children who then will grow up without mothers and families that are really, you know, torn apart because these girls can't even make it to the age of 20 because their bodies are doing things they're just not ready for.
You want to speak to that as well, Anne?
Yeah, I think Gail, you know, said it very well. We know that pregnancy is one of the leading causes of death for girls, and 90% of pregnancies among adolescents occur within marriage. So we know that that child marriage is one of the main drivers of maternal mortality in childhood. So if we want to do something about mothers dying or suffering or their children dying during pregnancy, we have no choice but to address and prevent and stop child marriage.
Gail, what parts of the world are we talking about?
I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about parts of sub-Saharan Africa. We're talking about parts of South Asia, where you see a lot of it. And, you know, one of the things that I've been looking at recently is looking at this connection between fragile states and insecurity and child marriage and poverty. And if you look at it, you know, three of the top 10 countries on the Fund for Peace's Failed State Index have child marriage rates above 50%. Nine of the bottom 11 countries on the UN Development Programs Human Development Index have child marriage rates over 40%. So there is a connection between stability of communities and what's happening to girls.
Well, which raises a question about how to bring, I mean, if you then brought more stability, not that that's an easy thing to do, Gail, but if you brought more stability to these parts of the world, would that then reduce child marriage?
Well, and it becomes circular, right? Because if you keep more children in school, you know, do you see more rates of stability? And in fact, you know, Arne Duncan, who I know you guys have talked to before, you know, the Secretary of Education has talked about how there's no better predictor of violence than the number of children out of school. And so the education piece becomes absolutely critical, because it's critical not just to stability, but also to fighting poverty.
Because if a girl gets education, that, I guess, increases the chance that she could work or contribute to family income. Is that what you mean, Gail?
That's right. And then also, you know, families start later. Children are healthier. Mothers die less often. Families are torn apart less frequently. You have more people who are able to continue to contribute to the household economically, and you have fewer children that you have to feed. And all of that become, you know, fewer demands on resources, and so I think you all of that starts to contribute to, and I'm not saying it's the only thing, but it contributes to economic and I think security stability.
And again, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to again say that, you know, the international community has come a long way in terms of getting more kids in school, boys and girls, and especially in primary school. We've really begun to close the gender gap at the primary level. At secondary level in many regions of the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, there's still a huge gap between the number of boys in school and the number of girls in school at the secondary level. So we have to pay attention to that particular level, and we can't forget about the gender dimensions, that the gender norms that would compel a parent, if a parent has limited resources, to choose to invest them in their sons more than their daughters. We are seeing good evidence that some of those trends are starting to change, and parents do want the best for their daughters. They do see the value of education, but we have to support them with more opportunities to be economically secure and to also see the vast potential that their daughters have when they are fully educated.
And do you see this as a foreign policy issue?
Yes, it's definitely a foreign policy issue, and the Council on Foreign Relations has literally written the book on this and talking about how child marriage is a fundamental foreign policy issue. And so Gail can say more about it, certainly, but what we know is when girls are in school, when they are getting educated, when they are able to work and earn an income to be healthy and to thrive, their communities do better, and that, you know, that lifts all boats in their countries, which has extremely beneficial outcomes for global development as well as global security.
Gail, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is for anybody who wants a safer, more secure, more stable world, which certainly development goals feature in U.S. foreign policy, as do the economic and security pieces. And really, for so long, I think the security people have looked at security stuff, and the women and girls people have looked at women and girls stuff, and the issues are absolutely connected. I did a Newsweek cover story in 2011 about Secretary Clinton's push to put women at the center of U.S. foreign policy, to not ignore the plight of women and girls, because she was arguing that it was central to what was happening in the world, that women, you know, in her view, were sort of the canary in the coal mine. If you looked at how women and girls were treated, you could see how a country was going to do in terms of economic and security terms. There are exceptions to that, but by and large, I think her case was very compelling, and it's one that we've really pushed at the Council in terms of trying to get people to see that these are not isolated issues. This is not happening in some alley of U.S. foreign policy. This is actually central to what kind of world your children and grandchildren will inherit, and whether, you know, U.S. Fundamental foreign policy goals will be achievable. And I do think that the development argument, the security argument, the stability argument all have women and girls and what's happening to them at the center of them.
And that's Gail Samak-Lamon, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us, Anne Warner, senior gender and youth specialist at the International Center for Research on Women. And we are talking about efforts to end child marriage. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Raj from Bryn Mawr to join us. Hi, Raj. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to make it clear that there are a lot of gray areas. The two comments I made were, one is age alone, unfortunately, is a very clean cutoff. The women that are married over 18 that get abused and treated like slaves. So age alone isn't a factor. And the second thing I wanted to mention was 18 is a sort of an arbitrary Western number. If you see other cultures, there are shorter lifespans, and children mature faster. They are responsible for house care and all that. So such hard numbers usually, I think, might not work in cultural context. I just wanted to make those comments.
No, Raj, I appreciate making those comments. It's an interesting one. Anne Warner, you say 18 is a Western number. Can you speak to that?
Well, I would disagree with that. I think that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, most of the countries in the world have signed on to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, establishing 18 as the legal age of adulthood. And many, many countries around the world do also in their national laws establish 18 as a law age of a majority and of a minimum age of marriage. And I think, you know, your point that children have, there are expectations on them to contribute to the household and the economy may be true, but I don't think that that's an ideal we should be striving for. We should be enhancing opportunities for children, to stay in school, to be protected by their families and communities, because that will ensure that they have the best transition to adulthood if they are able to reach the right age. And I think your point about 18, you know, if you're married above the age of 18, it doesn't necessarily mean your marriage is automatically blissful. I think that's a great point and a very important one. We need to look at more than age, and we need to look at the rights of women across the board and how those are reflected in family law and in other legal frameworks within countries to ensure that women have equal rights with men, and that they're able to seek the support of the justice system when they need to, and that they are protected from violence and discrimination at all levels.
Raj, thanks for the call to Radio Times. To you, Gail, in countries where there are laws prohibiting child marriage, are those laws enforced?
No, but they are not always. Sometimes they are, but oftentimes they are not. But either way, it's actually helpful. I was in a shelter in Afghanistan that was home to several girls who had been rescued from child marriage, all of whom had not wanted to be in that situation, most of whom were under the age of 15. And what happens is that most of the time those laws are ignored because they're happening in remote areas where enforcement of any laws, not just this one, is very difficult. But what you find is that advocates can then rely on the law and go to court and at least fight for these young women, these girls' chances.
Yeah.
With a law on their side. So I would never say it didn't make a difference. And also in northern India, where we were recently doing interviews, several parents talked about the fact that authorities had stopped marriages of girls under the age of 18 as being part of the reason why they were not marrying their girls, because they didn't want to have that, both the shame of having the marriage ceremony ended in public, and also everyone knowing that they had broken the law.
You know, Gail, I'm trying to imagine, again, being a 14 or 15 or 16-year-old escaping perhaps a violent marriage. And where does one go? I mean, obviously, there are some places in places like Afghanistan, but where does a young girl go?
Well, you know, oftentimes what I found in interviews is that girls will either go to families or neighbors or friends, and then that becomes a safety risk, actually, for everybody who's involved, right, especially in a place where it's a tradition. That's pretty entrenched, right? The people who are harboring these children then also face security risks themselves from angry family, who, because they're breaking up this impending marriage. And so when you have the law on your side, it sure is a lot easier to at least have that. But that does not guarantee that people will stay safe. And just one point to the previous caller, I certainly appreciate, where he is coming from. But, oftentimes I've received mail from people who say, listen, my grandmother was married at the age of 15 and she was perfectly happy. And why are you working on this? Or my grandmother was married at the age of 14. And my answer is always, well, so was mine. But that didn't mean that she wanted to have 11 children before the age of her mid-30s, or that she, if you look at what happened to the next generation, they were educated, and that trend broke. And I think that oftentimes we rely on culture as an excuse to not really listen to the girls who are involved in this, and even their families who don't necessarily want to have children who become brides and wives, but it's so difficult to stop because that's the norm.
And Gail, we're almost having a break here, but are you involved in this work because of your grandmother?
Not really. In fact, I didn't know that story until later.
Really?
But I, it's meeting these girls. It's meeting their families. You sit and listen to a girl who's 14, who's been pulled out of school, had her future taken from her, and even if she only had 4 years of school or 5 years of school or some, one case, 3 years of school, they will always talk to you about how all they want to do is be back in a classroom.
Wow. Let me reintroduce you. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. In fact, we're talking about the fight to end child marriage, and that's Gail Smuk-Lamone, again, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us, Anne Warner, senior gender and youth specialist at the International Center for Research on Women. We're taking calls, and Raj, thanks for that call. We're taking more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Pavarotti, Placido, and Pete? Just because they're not on stage at the Met, that doesn't mean rockers can't belt it out with the best of them. This week on Sound Opinions, we say bravo to our favorite rock operas.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Stephen Eric Clark tells us about his new novel, Sweetness Number 9. In the 1970s, a flavor chemist works on an artificial sweetener that becomes a popular sugar substitute, but he worries it's causing obesity and other problems in the country and in his family. And Adam Rogers tells us how to avoid a hangover. His new book is Proof. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Where you go to know, it's not just a catchphrase we throw out there because it's cute and it kind of rhymes. It's a statement of who we are and what we do at WHYY. Keeping you informed all day long wherever you are. At home, in the car, at the office, WHYY is there. On the radio, live online, or via podcast. The news you trust with the variety and depth you deserve from our award-winning journalists. WHYY. Anywhere you go, where you go to know.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. While some countries have passed laws against child marriage, a recent UNICEF report found that about 14 million girls under the age of 18 are still married off each year. The practice is particularly acute in countries that are experiencing instability because of conflict or natural disaster. We're talking with Ann Warner and Gail Samak-Limon, and again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. This is an email from Frank, picking up on something we touched on earlier, but I'll put this to you, Ann Warner. He writes in an email, it seems that a major impetus for child marriage is a cultural premium on female virginity, an attempt to marry off daughters before they lose their virginity consensually or more likely through rape. Is there any hope of changing deep-seated cultural attitudes towards female virginity in such societies? Can you take that, Ann?
Sure. Thank you so much for the question and very eloquently put. You're absolutely right, Frank, that that culturally rooted norms and expectations about female virginity and female sexuality are a huge contributing factor to child marriage. And societal attempts to regulate female sexuality lead to many bad things, including child marriage. I would say, though, that it is definitely not hopeless. What we know from looking at this issue around the world in many different places and looking at programs and from grassroots to kind of, you know, multi-country programs is that these practices and the traditions behind them do change. Traditions are not fixed. Traditions are not immutable. Malala Yousafzai, young activist,
our hero,
from,
right?
Yes, from Pakistan, who spoke at the Girl Summit in the UK last month, said so eloquently. Traditions are not sent from heaven; they are not sent from God. We make cultures, and we can change them. That's a little bit of a paraphrase, but still a really powerful quote from an incredibly powerful spokesperson about how cultures can change if we collectively decide that they must.
Again, I'd love to have you speak to that as well. And obviously, we're talking about the problem of child marriages, but there is work going on to address the issue, and we've focused a little bit on education. What else has been effective?
You know, I think education is a huge piece of it, and you know, to Ann's point about Malala Yousafzai, I mean, these young women, when you meet them, these girls, right, who are, you know, 13, 14, I met some who are 9 and 10 and 11, particularly in southern Afghanistan and some in other parts of India, you know, they are the most eloquent champions for their own change and their own futures that you could possibly meet. Right? It's just that we don't often hear from them. We don't often enough hear from them. You know, and I was in Afghanistan for years trying to get people to pay attention to what was going on with girls' education, and sort of people's eyes glaze over when you say the world's girls' education. And then you have someone like Malala Yousafzai who, through real tragedy, gains this platform and shows people the stakes. And I do think that for the global community, that's what it takes. But on the ground, you see, you know, young girls and their families who are fighting for their futures every single day. And I think in addition to education, unconditional cash transfers and conditional cash transfers seem to have made a difference in certain countries. The World Bank has studied it. ICRW is studying it now. Does helping families look at the economic piece differently? of having girl children change the way they view marriage. And I do think that that is absolutely part of the conversation about ending it.
And Gail, where do you think those girls, I mean, even beyond Malala, where do they get that spirit?
I think it is absolutely the human spirit that is entirely universal. This desire to achieve your own potential and to be who you can become, that has nothing to do with where you're born. And I've seen it from girls in the most difficult circumstances. And you ask, you know, why do you write about this? It's because of them. It's because you listen to them and you think, gosh, what if the next, you know, Steve Jobs were married at age 11? What if the next, you know, Maya Angelou was married at age 12? Think of all the talent the world misses out on because these girls are compelled into marriage before they can, their bodies and their minds and their hearts can handle it.
You know, and as we're talking, I'm thinking about those girls that were kidnapped by Boko Haram. I guess they've been married. I don't know whether they've been married off or not, but just the sort of horror of that. We've been talking about parents who, for whatever reason, sometimes marry their girl children off to adults, but I'm thinking about these girls that were kidnapped.
Yeah, it's a horrific situation, yes. and unfortunately, we don't know much about the fate of those girls, and there have been some rumors that they may have been married off, and it's just, you know, that's another kind of type of forced and child marriage.
I mean, that's slavery. Wouldn't that be the definition
absolutely,
of slavery?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I think marriage is not at all the right terminology in this case. That's a euphemism for something that is a fundamental denial of girls' most basic rights.
Let me get Andrea from Middletown, New York, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if either of the women speaking could talk about any collaborations that they do with grassroots organizations within the countries where child marriage seems to be a problem.
Sure.
Speaking to sort of the feminist uprising, perhaps, if there is any, of the women in those countries working with their own daughters and communities.
Andrea, I'm going to toss that to Gail Samak-Lamon. Go ahead, Gail.
Sure. I'll start this. You know, at the Council on Foreign Relations, we don't do anything really but framing the issue in policymakers. It's not advocacy work, but really trying to frame the issue as one that should matter to U.S. policymakers. But on the ground, absolutely. I've met a lot of young women through organizations, a lot of girls, through organizations that are doing the work grassroots. You know, in Afghanistan, there are a number of Afghan and Afghan-American women who are running shelters, who are working with girls. I think in every country, in India, in much of sub-Saharan Africa, you have grassroots organizations on the ground who are working with this. Often they're underfunded and under-resourced, but you do, given the scope of the problem, but there are certainly people leading this on the ground.
And I would assume, Anne Werner, that's key, right?
It is absolutely key. Thank you so much for the question. ICRW certainly works in collaboration with grassroots organizations as well as larger implementing organizations and research organizations. And what we see is there really is, there are indigenous homegrown movements that are taking on the issue of child marriage and that have been taking it on for you know, far longer than we have here in this country. We're catching up to an issue that's been recognized as critical and harmful by women's rights activists, by child rights activists, even by cultural and religious leaders who see the tremendous harms that are being done. Girls Not Brides is a wonderful global movement of organizations, including grassroots organizations from around the world. Girls Not Brides has created a sort of global umbrella for those groups. And they're doing powerful work, and I would encourage anybody who's interested to look at the Girls Not Brides website and learn more about them.
Andrea, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have a tweet from Casey. Casey says, I'm conflicted about the undertones of cultural imperialism. And just since you were talking about some of the grassroots work, what's your response to that? And do you run into that?
Sure, we do. But I'll just reiterate what I just said, is that to a great extent, the movement against child marriage is led by communities themselves, and increasingly, as Gail said, by girls themselves, who know that this is not the best option for their lives and who are seeking support. And we see it as our obligation and commitment to provide those girls and their families and communities with support to find a better life. I think that cultural relativism argument starts to fade away when you actually go to communities and talk to girls and women who understand deep in their guts that this is wrong and that they are asking for more attention and more support from global groups and from donors to help them develop alternatives to child marriage.
You want to speak to that, Gail?
I do, absolutely, because actually I think it's the opposite, in that the world and the international community is following girls on the ground. They are not leading this discussion. If anything, they are late to the game in terms of what girls on the ground have been fighting for as long as I've been interviewing them, and for many, many years more than that, I would imagine. And if you look at NGOs on the ground and organizers on the ground who are fighting this, they've been at this for decades. I think it is an understandable conversation and an important conversation to have, but this is not something that is being imposed by foreigners. If you're going to talk about should girls be in on the conversation about what happens to them, what happens to their own lives, I think it's the ultimate imperialism to say that they get no voice.
Let me get Brian from Newark, Delaware to join us. Hi, Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is to see if there's actually any data, if there's any research on male children being married. I sort of wanted to put this on a bit of a spin from the topic you're talking about already, with female girls being, married off at a very young age. And I wanted to see if there's any research or if there's any data being done to understand about male children being married off.
All right, Brian, let me see if Ann Warner can answer your question.
Sure, thanks. That's a really thoughtful question. If I haven't said it yet, I should say that child marriage overwhelmingly does affect girls who are married to older spouses. So fundamentally, girls are bearing the brunt of child marriage around the world. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't child grooms out there, and that child marriage doesn't have very harmful outcomes for them as well. There is increasing research on that, not a whole lot just yet, but there's some more research coming out of India, for example. And I think that where ICRW is focusing on this is focusing on the fact that girls are most affected by child marriage, and we need to understand those profound effects. And we also need to look at how child marriage has such detrimental effects on the family unit, on children, and on broader communities, and making sure that we engage men and boys in that conversation. And there are really great examples of where that's happening in Ethiopia and India, all around the world, where men recognize, as well as women and girls do, that this has harmful effects, and that they can and should step out against early marriage.
We have an email from Randall. He says, it seems that the phenomenon of dowries has been overlooked so far. Is that part of this conversation, Gail?
Yeah, absolutely. And Randall's exactly right. I mean, I think that is an important part of the discussion. And I think that's part of why the discussion about cash transfers has been really central. It's sort of, can you think about girl children as contributors rather than burdens to a family? And part of that, and some of the ICRW work, is to look at whether this program that the Indian government started, it's a state in India, started in 1994 and then it went national afterward, could look at revaluing girl children. Dowry is a really hard practice to stop because the traditions, and it's so difficult for men and for women and for the families. Mm-hmm. You know, this can really break a family in terms of the economics of it. And so you see a lot of governments really trying to look at this practice, but it's, I think, like all pretty entrenched traditions, a tough one to stop.
Well, Anne, I mean, it seems a culture, no matter what culture you're talking about, that's one of the hardest things to change because of the traditions and the rituals and just how personal it is as well.
It is. You know, anywhere in the world, marriage is a complex decision. It's made for a variety of reasons, including economic reasons, including cultural reasons and very personal reasons. But when we're talking about child marriage, we're seeing those personal individual preferences being taken away, and we're seeing the influence of the economic and some of the social factors really dominating because there are fewer choices for families to make, and then girls have no choice in the matter. So I think, you know, again, we have to look at the economic drivers. What chronic poverty, as well as economic shocks caused by natural disasters or conflict, due to families, and how we can more effectively support families, protect them against these shocks, and make sure that girls don't suffer the brunt of the disadvantages that families are facing in poor settings around the world.
And 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, Gail, are you optimistic that this issue can be addressed and in certain ways fixed?
I think that absolutely. I am optimistic because I think that the international community has finally started to follow the lead of girls on the ground and really pay attention to it. And I think that international policymakers are really starting to see this as the critical economic and security and stability issue that it is.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Gail Samak-Lamon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, contributing editor to the Atlantic's Defense One website. And Anne Warner, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Senior gender and youth specialist at the International Center for Research on Women. She leads the center's research on solutions to end the practice of child marriage. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can download podcasts of the program. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter and find out about satellite radio and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Kevin Griffin, Joyce Lieberman, the engineers for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.